We are in the condition we are in the state of ignorance we are in the state of war, in the state of economic depression, in the state of depletion of the resources of our planet because of the greed of psychopaths who thought they could create their own reality. Well, look at the reality they created.
You're listening to Stop Talk Radio, the world for people who think.
Hello and welcome to Soft Talk Radio. I'm your host, Neil Bradley. With me tonight, Joe Quinn.
Hi there.
Juliana Balmbuen.
Hello.
And Pierre Lescaudron.
Hello.
This week we're delighted to be talking with Lierre Keith. Lierre is an American author, an activist. She's the author of one book in particular that we just can't get enough of. We've been talking about it for a couple of years. I think it's been out 3 years. It's called The Vegetarian Myth: Food, Justice, and Sustainability. It stimulated a lot of discussion online, even on our own forum. I think we have a thread on this book running into 100 pages or more, for good reason. There's a lot of great insights, a lot of good research has gone into it. And we're delighted to have Lierre here with us today. Lierre, can you hear us?
Yeah, loud and clear, and thanks for having me on your show.
Welcome. It's great to have you here.
So we're going to discuss the vegetarian myth. Maybe the first question that pops up in my mind is in the beginning of your book.
Well, yes. I have a more primordial question than that. What is the vegetarian myth? That's the title of the book. It sounds like there's a myth around vegetarianism. Is it something that can be summed up in a few words or couple of paragraphs, maybe?
Yeah. Yes, we can do this. So I would say there are three parts to the vegetarian myth. And I just want to start by saying I come to this as someone who was actually a vegan for almost 20 years. So I have been in that world, you know, as deeply as one can be. And there are three main reasons that people take up a vegetarian or a vegan diet. The first is that they think it's better for the planet. The second is that they think it's better for human justice, so more people will be fed if we only eat this way. And the third reason is that they think it's better for their health. And so altogether, those, I think, make this thing called the vegetarian myth. Now, I want to be clear that I didn't call it the vegetarian lie. There are pieces of truth in all of this, but put together, none of this actually holds up. And it took me 20 years to figure that out. So I wanted to try to reach the people who care the most about those subjects, about the earth, about justice, and about their health, and try to explain to them why they needed a bigger perspective, or at least to try to engage more with the information. Because I think for a lot of us, we think we have the answers, and you know, we hang on to these ideologies sometimes too strongly. And it's really hard when we come up against counter-information to then look at that information. So my goal was to try to reach the other people who were still in that world and explain to them what I had found out, because it turned out that a lot of what I believed was simply not true. And it wasn't that the underlying values were wrong. It's that the information that I had wasn't complete. And with bigger information, I ended up making very different choices.
And apparently during this process of realization, you had a crucial experience when you decided, yeah, I'm a vegan, so I'm going to grow my own food. And, of course, to grow my own food, being vegan, I won't use animal product. And then you started to realize that it was not this easy to eat without relying on animal products and without participating to the destruction of the planet. Is it the way this experience happened?
Yes, and it happened over a few years, of course. We don't have these realizations overnight. But, you know, I heard that one of the best things you can do is try to grow your own food. And that was something that I was very passionate about. I wanted to be engaged, you know, in the whole cycle beginning to end. But the problem was that I didn't understand what soil actually is. And it's a living thing. In fact, it's billions of living things. And many of those little things are animals. And it's those creatures that keep the world alive, quite literally. They are the ones that are doing the basic work of life. So they're making nutrients available to the rest of us who simply can't do that. We can't see most of them, right? They're smaller than our eyes can perceive. But with a microscope, certainly this whole world opened up to scientists and then just to regular people. We can all see now what they're doing. And without them, there would be no life. So it's up to them, you know, to keep the world moving. We're just kind of like the icing on the cake on top here. I mean, nothing we do is really that important. So, you know, back to soil, I mean, this is the basis of terrestrial life, is this living thing called soil. And, you know, it's hungry. And what it wants to eat is dead plants and dead animals. And I didn't understand that. I think a lot of us think of soil as just like insensate dirt, you know, just kind of matter that just sits there. And it's not. It's teeming with life. So mm-hmm. if you don't feed it, it dies. You know, it's got to have what it needs. And that's what soil is the dead bodies of animals and plants worked upon by even smaller creatures to recycle those nutrients and make them available again into that whole cycle of life. So I, you know, came up against this when I tried to garden as a vegan. The ground really wanted bone meal and it wanted blood meal. You know, it wanted dead animal parts. Mm-hmm. And it was really horrifying to me, as I think it is to a lot of vegetarians who come up against this. And some of them refuse to do it. And every year their garden gets more and more depleted. Their vegetables are tiny, and they are more and more depleted every year trying to eat this food that just has no minerals in it. I mean, they're literally mining the soil. They're pulling the minerals out and then not replacing them. Mm-hmm. So that was a real problem for me, and I tried to find various ways around it, you know, sort of in my head, making little workarounds. But in the end, I just had to admit it. Like, the soil wants manure, and it wants some dead animals in there, and that was really hard. And then the other problem was that you have to kill things to garden. And I didn't want to kill things. You know, I thought that I really wanted my life to be possible without death, and it wasn't, you know. So I was telling myself a story, and it was a very lovely story, but it's a fairy tale, you know. So in order for me to eat, it meant that all these other creatures couldn't eat that food. So we were engaged in a battle for this food, and this particularly, you know, came to a head around slugs, because as anyone who gardens anywhere that there's water knows, the slugs will eat your garden overnight, and there's just nothing left mm-hmm. in the morning. So I kept replanting, and then I kept re-eating. And we went through that cycle 5 or 6 times, and at the end of 2 weeks, I was very tired of replanting the same heads of lettuce. And, you know, I had to kill them. It was me or the slugs. And it was really horrible because I couldn't make myself do it. So, you know, the end of that little story was I ended up getting chickens and ducks because I figured, well, they'll do it for me. Which they did, and it was really great. Mm-hmm. Then I had manure. Now I closed the circle. I didn't have to buy fossil fuel fertilizer. I didn't have to buy stuff at the feed store. You know, they had the manure right there, but it meant that my food was ultimately dependent on those animals to kill other animals. I mean, it was like there was no way out of this, right? I mean, mm-hmm. I had to face that I needed the animals, and some of them were going to have to die. And it was really just so, it was just grueling for me to have to go through that. But I didn't know better. And this is the thing. This is not to blame me. It's not to blame any of us. We don't know. We don't live in a world where we're given the truth from a young age. You know, this is the cost of being alive. Something else is going to die. And you need to respect all the lives that are going to go into yours and do this well and participate and give thanksgiving and be humble about it, because your turn's going to come too, and you'll be feeding the cycle at some point. And if we had a culture that recognized that, well, we wouldn't be destroying the planet, which is what we're doing. So this is what I'm trying to get across to people, is, you know, you can only get so far ideologically out of this before reality is going to smack you in the face.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a lesson right there for vegetarians. I mean, when you say that you got chickens and ducks and you allow them to eat the slugs and other insects in your garden, that's part of the cycle, right? So why are humans not part of that cycle where pretty much everything seems to be feeding on everything else to survive,
and you said
on other life forms?
And you said something really important on your book about it, when you say, well, people basically have choices. The death that's destroying life, which is what most people do, or the death that is part of life. And yeah, it's part of us accepting that you're dependent on the whole system, and you should respect it at each level, right?
Yes, and for me, you know, when I was in that vegan mindset, I thought that that was domination. That was all I saw when I looked out, and I didn't want to be part of a dominating hierarchy. So, you know, my attempt was to remove myself from it and say, well, I'm not one of the dominators. I'm going to be somebody who respects life by not taking life. But it turned out that that was not possible, you know, that every breath I took was dependent on the death of some creature somewhere. Every time you put your teeth together, you're killing billions of bacteria.
Yeah,
and those are bacteria that like you. You know, those are bacteria that are trying to help you. They live in your body. They help you digest your food. You can't help it. It's just, it's part of what it is. You know, we have to kill some things in order to live. But it was just a terrible realization for me. It took me years to wrap my mind around it and to accept it emotionally. It's really hard. And I think that's one of the problems with the ideology that often comes with being vegetarian or vegan. You know, you start to create your identity around it, and then it just becomes really hard to question it when it starts to fall apart. So I think just so many people go through this kind of collapse of their worldview when, for whatever reason, you know, the other information starts to invade. It starts to crack your system, and it's just it's a terrible process for many of us. It's very painful.
I think it's actually one of the most remarkable things about your book and you is that you came from that place where you didn't want to. You had a resistance or an abhorrence of killing something else, to come to the point not only of getting over that and, you know, accepting that you have to kill a lot of things to live, as most other species on the planet do, but also then to write a book about it. That's pretty unique, because I don't see many other people. Not only I also don't see people making that transition, and not many people actually writing about it. You know, so congratulations.
Well, you know,
yeah, you know.
Well, thank you. I really want to reach the other people who feel the way that I feel, because there's a lot of people who are incredibly impassioned about what's happening to our planet. They feel the emergency of it, and they think they're doing the right thing by eating a vegetarian or a vegan diet. And I really wanted to explain to them that the original wound to this planet, the most destructive activity that we've done, is agriculture. So suggesting those foods as a way to save the planet is completely in the wrong direction. But I didn't know that as a vegan. In fact, I couldn't let myself know it. So I'm trying to reach... It really has to be someone who's been in that world, you know, to be able to address other people who are still there, I think. I think it's easier for me. Yeah.
Was there something about your upbringing that instilled this idea within you? Because it's not, I wouldn't say it's common. I mean, it may be common enough, but I don't think the majority of people actually think that way about, from a relatively early age, think that way about eating meat, for example.
Well, I was born in 1964, so my whole childhood, you know, took place amongst that whole, you know, uprising and cultural change, the civil rights movement and the anti-war movement, and that was all going around me. It had a huge impression on me as a young kid. I mean, I was only 4 when Martin Luther King was shot, but I remember that day, and I remember Kent State when the protesters were shot. I mean, these were huge moments, you know, very impressionable age. And my parents were fairly engaged in all of that. I mean, they're not super radical, but they cared a lot, and they taught me to care about the world. They taught me that I really had to be engaged. So I sort of took the ball and ran with it in different radical directions, but I got a really good foundation from my parents, and that's something that I'm forever grateful for. You know, and they also turned the television off and read books to us, which... I don't know if anybody does it anymore, but it was
was
before computers, obviously, but it was like, no, it's way more important to play outside, it's way more important to talk to each other, and it's really important to read and to care about books. So all of that was part of my childhood, and that's a great foundation. You know, you can take that anywhere.
Yeah, you were mentioning the agriculture and its destructive nature, and I think while deconstructing the vegetarian myth, you made a even more important discovery, i.e. the true nature of agriculture, because vegetarian or not, most consumers are participating to a system that literally destroy our planet. So can you explain more about how modern days agriculture destroy the planet?
Yes. So you have to understand what agriculture is in very brute terms. You take a piece of land, and you clear every living thing off it. And I mean down to the bacteria. Everything has to go. And then on that cleared land, you plant food for humans and humans only. So we got a couple problems here. The first is that it's biotic cleansing. I mean, we talk about ethnic cleansing where you kill people and take their land. Well, this is biotic cleansing because you're killing entire biotic communities. You're just clearing them off. You're driving them away. And that's a long-winded way of saying mass extinction. We are now losing 200 species a day. Every day, 200 species are gone forever. And those are our kin. You know, those are our brothers and sisters. We need them. And we need to mourn their loss so that we will do something to stop this bleed. But that's what agriculture is. So, you know, one problem is you're extirpating all those other creatures, and they've got nowhere to go. If you take their homes away, where can they go? So that's it. It's over. So that's problem number one. Problem number two is that it lets the human population grow to these really large numbers. Because instead of sharing that land with, you know, millions of other creatures, you're only growing humans on that piece of land. So, you know, to put a number on this, for a hunter-gatherer in the kind of climate that I live in, just your basic temperate forest, it takes about a square mile to provide for their basic needs. For an agriculturalist in this same climate, it only takes about an acre, right? That's because you're not sharing that land. It's because you're only growing a human. So you can grow a lot more humans, right? But nobody else can live there. That's the problem. Mm-hmm. And where I live in Northern California, 100 years ago, you could sit by any stream or river in Northern California. Every 15 minutes, you would see a grizzly bear. Now, grizzly bears are apex predators, which means they're at the top of that trophic pyramid. It takes a lot of food and a lot of land to feed something as big as a grizzly bear. But every 15 minutes, you would see a grizzly bear. That's how much abundance there was here. That's how much life. There are no longer any grizzly bears in California. Okay, they're all gone. And you could pick your species and tell the same incredibly sad story, and that's what agriculture has done. They've got nowhere to go. They cannot coexist with agriculture. So there's that problem, the overpopulation problem. And so right now, 80% of the food calories that support our current population, they come from agriculture. Okay, so what that means is that the human race, I mean, set aside the last 46 remaining tribes of hunter-gatherers, they're still doing something sustainable, but the rest of us, we've made ourselves dependent on this activity that is literally killing the planet. That is a scary thought. And the final problem is that in the process of doing all of this thing called agriculture, what the main thing that you're also destroying is the soil itself, because you have to expose it year after year in order to plant those seeds. And every time you expose the soil, you destroy it. You're killing it. It's alive, like you and me, and when it's exposed to air, you know, to wind, to the sun, to the rain, to all that stuff, it just dries up and blows away. So, you know, you have these massive dust storms now, and that's why when you clear away the cover, either the grasses or the trees, and you expose it, it just turns to dust and sand. And that's why if you go around the globe, all the places where agriculture first started, they're just so degraded, you can't even believe there was ever a forest there. I mean, Iraq, Iran, you know, the whole Middle East, all around the Mediterranean. I mean, we think of that area as, I mean, now if you picture, say, Italy or something, you have this sort of picture of sort of scrubby rock in the sun with goats browsing on it. That was a forest. In fact, it was a forest so dense that sunlight never touched the ground. And it was all destroyed, you know, to build, you know, pick your navy, whether it was the Phoenicians, the Egyptians, the Greeks, finally the Romans. I mean, that entire area was just clear-cut for one militaristic endeavor after another. But that is the inevitable endpoint of agriculture. This society is always end up militarized. They always end up based on slavery. And that's just a logical progression when your society is based on an extractive activity, which is what agriculture is. So you're extirpating all these species. You've got this ballooning population of humans that are dependent on the continued destruction of the planet, and you're destroying the topsoil, which is the basis of life. So these are three really big problems with agriculture, and none of them can be fixed. I mean, this is not agriculture on a bad day. It's what the activity is. That is what it means. So a lot of people will try to make a distinction between, like, industrial agriculture, but that's not the real problem. That's, you know, agriculture on steroids. Yes, they've added fossil fuel, they've made it worse, but the problem itself is agriculture. It's taking over whole living communities, destroying them, and then just using it for humans until the whole thing gives out.
Mm-hmm. So that's largely from an ideological perspective, but is it not sustainable? Just playing devil's advocate here for a moment. Is it not sustainable, for example, with fossil fuels that produce the fertilizer to continue to use, even though it's kind of, it's false in a way, it's not real fertilizer, but let's just say we continue to have oil-based, basically, fertilizer. Is it not possible to continue and have it be sustainable in terms of continuing to grow crops that way?
Okay, right. Well, so two problems. One is that the fossil fuel will eventually run out. Now, we can live in fairyland and say that somehow we will find more. And yes, scientists are very good at continuing to find ways to get the stuff out of the ground. There are now wells in places like Pennsylvania that catch on fire because of the fracking. If you want to turn on your faucet and get something that catches on fire, we can keep trying to get the oil and the gas out of the ground. You know, oil spills, I mean, all the rest of it, it's just an incredibly destructive activity. But we can put that aside. Pretend that there will be an ever-flowing amount, and it will never end. We will always find more. All right, fine. Let's say that's true. It's insane, but we'll pretend that's true. There are real problems with using fossil fuel as a fertilizer. One is that it mostly just includes nitrogen. And the problem with soil and ultimately plant life is that it needs a lot more than just nitrogen. That's only one thing. That's only one nutrient that plants need. That's a big one, clearly. But you also need potassium, you need calcium, you need just a whole range of different minerals that are all limiting factors. So when those minerals run out, plant growth simply stops. And so this is a real problem for not just gardeners, but really the big farmers, because they're always needing to find more sources of these things, and they're running out around the globe. There's only so much you can mine to get these minerals back into the soil. And so you need to understand the difference between annuals and perennials. So agriculture is based on annual grasses. And the thing about annuals is that they only grow, they're called annuals because they only live for a year. Well, they don't even really live a year. It's really just two or three seasons. And in that time, they have one goal, and that goal is to make a great big seed. Okay, that's the whole future of their species depends on that seed. So all of their resources, all of their biological resources go into making that seed as big and sturdy and tough and, packed with whatever it's going to need. They try to give everything to that seed because, it all depends on that seed getting a good start in life. So annuals don't tend to be very tall, and they do not tend to be deep-rooted. They don't have time, right? Everything, they've got this, they're on the clock. The moment that they're born, it's like, got to get that seed made, and then they die. So because they don't have a deep root system, they can't do what perennials do. So if you compare the roots of a perennial grass to an annual grass, the annuals only go down a few feet. The perennials go down and down and down. And whether it's grasses or trees, they have roots that are so incredibly strong and deep, they actually burrow into the rock that our planet is made of. And here's the point. They eat that rock. They break it down. They pull up the minerals from that rock, and then they make it available to the rest of life on Earth. And that is why there is minerals in the soil. And that is why the rest of us are alive, is because those perennial plants, be it grasses or trees, can eat rocks, okay? And they can make those minerals biologically available. If all you're adding back to that soil is nitrogen, you're missing all the rest of them. So eventually the soil's going to die. It's not going to be, the plants aren't going to be able to survive. They're going to be stunted, The whole thing eventually ends in collapse if all you're applying is nitrogen, because life needs a lot more than just nitrogen. You can limp it along for a few generations, and they have, but ultimately it's going to die. And then you have that basic problem of every time you expose the soil, which you have to do to plant annual crops, you're killing it. So it just powders, it just turns into dust. Right now the dust storms in China are so bad that these dust clouds reach all the way across the Pacific Ocean, and then they hit the Rocky Mountains in the United States. So they come down. All that dust falls down in places like Denver, Colorado, which is up in the Rockies, literally creating asthma in children in Denver. Mm-hmm. And this is from dust storms in China. And that is the inevitable endpoint of agriculture. You can look at photographs from the first day of the Dust Bowl in South Dakota, and it's just this massive cloud of dust. I mean, it was so dark people fell down outside. Like, they couldn't see where they were going. And that's all of the topsoil that just blew right off. And that's what happens when you remove the grasses. There's literally nothing to hold the soil in place. And the moment that there's wind, it's over. So there were farms in South Dakota that lost all of their soil. I mean, think of it, all of their soil in one day, the first day of the Dust Bowl. And the soil rolled in across the continent all the way to Washington, D.C., and then all the way into the Atlantic Ocean. There were ships in the Atlantic that couldn't navigate because the dust storms were so bad. And that was all the soil from the prairie that just blew out to sea. And that is what agriculture does. You can apply as much fossil fuel as you want. It doesn't change the basic nature of this activity.
Mm-hmm. And in the end, it comes back to bite us. I think it was in the book, The Magnesium Miracle. I can't remember the author's name. She cited a study from 1913 that analyzed the mineral content in soil in the U.S. And they found then that magnesium was way off, that as a result, children in the U.S. were not getting sufficient magnesium in their diet to either meat or plants. Mm-hmm. Because the topsoil was so severely depleted at that point.
So mass agriculture basically is producing malnourished and weakened human beings that are feeding on it, and this is coming at a time, and it's getting worse and worse. It's cumulative in the sense that as the topsoil continues to degrade and degrade, you get lower and lower quality of crops, let's say, if people are eating mainly cereals. And this is coming at a time now, I don't know if you've been noticing the air, but there's a lot of crazy stuff going on around the planet in terms of climate change or earth changes, that isn't helping the situation at all.
No, I totally agree. A lot of people talk about, and a lot of it is just due to this agriculture. Another thing about having those deep-rooted plants is that that's what lets the water table recharge, because their roots are really deep. And every time it rains, that makes a little channel. Every root is a little tiny channel that pulls water down. And so that's how the water literally gets down into the water table. And then it recharges that table. And then during drier times, of course, again, the deeply rooted perennials can pull that water up as it's needed and make it available in whatever form to the rest of the community. So without those perennial plants, the water's never stored. It just runs off the top of the soil. And then, you get floods, terrible floods, and you get, and not just floods of water, but floods with all that dirt, all that silt, that just completely destroys rivers and the life of those rivers. And then it all piles up at the mouth of rivers. And you can look at this, through history, archaeologically, there were ports in Rome along the coast of the Mediterranean that were, the big Roman ports. They had to be moved 2 and 3 times because so much soil had washed down off the mountains. The ports were just completely clogged and the boats couldn't get anymore. The ships couldn't dock. So they kept having to move the ports to match where the topsoil was building up. So anyway, yes, all of that is to say, I completely agree that, and so they call it mining the soil, because every time you plant the annuals, of course, they're sucking minerals out, but they've got no way to replace it because annual plants simply can't do that.
And if I correctly understand, there is a paradox, because somehow hunter-gatherers were eating mostly animals, were preserving, or they were not destroying their biotope, so wilderness could bloom around. At the same time, modern vegetarians that are heavily relying on farming and products coming from farming, intensive farming, contribute directly or indirectly to the destruction of those wildlife biotopes and to destruction of wildlife. So the hunter-gatherer who consumes meats doesn't threaten the continuation of wildlife, of animals' life, while the vegetarian who doesn't eat any meat contributes to the destruction of wildlife and animals. So everything is reversed.
Yeah, that was really hard for me to come to terms with as a vegetarian. But what you're saying is exactly true. So there's two ways to look at, like in ancient Greek, there's two words for life. And one of them means a specific life, and the other one means sort of the life of the whole, the life of the species. And this, again, is really the only choices we have. You know, we can kill one individual, but the species goes on, or we can kill the entire species and pretend we're not doing it. But that's what agriculture is, because you're taking over their homes, right? You're making it impossible for them to live there.
But, Lear, I wanted to ask you, I mean, it seems that there's a... It's really hard to convey this to people, and we've had, like, crazy, wild reactions from just sharing your book. And, I mean, we published your book in French, you know, and the very first, like, I think it had been online or available for, like, 4 days. Nobody had read it yet. And there was a massive campaign, you know, just to say, well, this is stupid, this is whatever, you know. And I'm sure you have a club there of haters or, you know, people who just don't even want to hear the evidence. And I'm wondering if, you know, because of all you said about the diet and the nutritional aspect as well, and the effect that grains can have on the brain, you know, how do we get out of this vicious circle? Because people are being malnourished and are having this sort of cognitive, you know, blockage there where they can't think, they can't question what they've been told for years and years and years. So they go on the attack or on just plain denial. How do you go about, you know, trying to, you know, put the truth out there and at the same time, you know, understanding that maybe what's causing this blockage is an effect of what they're eating, actually?
It's a very hard thing to have to tell people because, well, they don't want to hear it. But a lot of times their behavior is the best evidence. I mean, they're proving my point better than I ever could.
Yeah.
But I've been there, and I know how my brain felt when I did not have enough good quality animal fat. In fact, I had no animal fat for almost 20 years. And it's just horrible. You cannot keep a stable mood.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I would lose my – I couldn't, like, if I couldn't find my wallet or my keys or something, I would sit on the floor and cry. Like, I just couldn't. There was no way. Just the tiny little things in life that go wrong, there was no resilience at all in my brain. Mm. And the moment I started eating eggs, it got better. Like, within 2 days, I was a different person. And that wasn't even, like, you know, fabulous amounts of animal fat or bacon or anything really good. It was just eggs. But eating eggs for a few days in a row, I couldn't believe how much better I felt. And this is true, you know, just statistically speaking, people on low-fat diets have, like, a tremendously higher suicide rate. I think they're 4 times as likely to commit suicide. Also, they're way more likely to die a violent death. So they have a higher murder rate. So they are murdered more than people who eat, like, regular diets. And all of this I have seen. It is really, the suicide rate is horrible. And I know why. You know, you don't have enough tryptophan, so you can't make serotonin. We all know serotonin is, you know, the happy thing you need when you have to take Prozac. But you could just eat food. And, in fact, a lot of depression goes away from simply eating an appropriate diet for a few days. I've seen this over and over. I've experienced it myself. It's kind of an amazing thing. And actually, the best book on this is Julia Ross's book. It's called The Mood Cure. And this is her life's work. She is a... that's her field. She works with addiction and depression, and she treats it nutritionally and has just a stupendous success rate. So if these are issues that any of your listeners are dealing with, depression or addiction or anxiety, that is a fabulous book. It's called The Mood Cure, and this is what she goes into, the biochemistry of the brain and how if you don't have enough protein and good quality animal fat, you are so at risk for things like depression and addiction. Addiction in particular, because it's your brain is trying to normalize, it's trying to stabilize. And if you're fighting your brain, you're not going to win. I mean, your brain is going to crave until it gets what it needs. So this is not an emotional failing. It's not a political failing or an ethical failing. It's simply biologically true. You need certain things. But it's really hard. A lot of the people who email me, I think one of the conditions that I hear over and over is the depression and anxiety, and they go ahead and they try it because they're so desperate. So they will eat a more appropriate human diet for a few days, and then they write to me and they say, you saved my life. You know, I was so depressed I couldn't get out of bed. I can't believe how much better I feel. And I've gotten those emails over and over, and it absolutely makes up for the hate mail because just know that. You know, I saved somebody from, and I lost 20 years of my life to depression. I know how bad it gets. I mean, I have nothing but compassion for these people, But they need to broaden out a tiny bit if they want relief, because eating what they're eating, they're never going to feel okay.
It occurs to me that I know we're talking about vegetarians here and we're laying a lot of the blame on vegetarians, but it seems to me that there'd be an awful lot more people who are not vegetarians who would have a serious problem with the idea of getting rid of industrial agriculture, i.e. and the reduction in availability of cereals and grains that would involve, because a lot of people, I think most people, especially in the Western world, who eat meat, it's only a small part of their diet compared to cereals and grains, and they're kind of addicted to them because basically cereals and grains break down into sugars in your body, and sugars are not only addictive but very harmful to human beings, to human health. They're the source of a lot of modern illnesses that didn't exist 100 years ago.
Not to mention gluten and casein in dairy products and in some cereals that create an actual addiction, like you're saying there.
So what do you think about that, Pierre, in terms of, I mean, the problem is also non-vegetarians, meat eaters, and their addiction to cereals. I mean, most of them have been addicted to, Cheerios and all sorts of cereal, as in breakfast cereal, but also pastas and breads and everything. I mean, it's, people will fight for that.
They are incredibly addictive substances, at least for some of us. And I say this as someone who knows. Like gluten, for instance, when it's being digested, goes through your digestive tract. For some of us anyway, it actually turns into gluteomorphine, which is exactly what it sounds like. It's a form of morphine that's made from gluten. And it's really addictive. I have been completely gluten-free for a few years now. I actually had a diagnosis of an autoimmune disease, and I was like, well, that's it. I cannot ever eat gluten again, even for a treat now and then. Took it out of my diet completely. And I got to say, just as an aside, it made a huge difference. So even the little bit of gluten that I was eating was still triggering the autoimmune response. But that's an aside. It does. It turns into morphine for some of us. And, okay, obviously that's addictive. And there are actually some people who have suggested that this is the reason we took up agriculture. None of the other explanations actually make sense. What I was taught in school when I was, in elementary school was, well, the human population got too big and there wasn't enough food to go around, so people had to intensify their use of their land base, and that meant learning to do agriculture, and that was a great thing because now look how many people there are. And that was pretty much the story we got told, when I was 10. Well, the problem is the archaeological evidence doesn't match that story. You don't see signs of chronic hunger and deficiency diseases. So the human population did not push this activity to happen. We actually don't know why people started doing agriculture. It doesn't make any sense. It's backbreaking labor for pretty poor nutrition. So why would anybody do this? And, the one explanation is, well, we did it because it was addictive, because people liked how they felt when they ate those annual seeds, and here we are. And that, to me, is the only explanation that makes any sense, mostly because I've experienced it myself. I know the call of wheat. It calls for me from across town. Come, eat a muffin, eat a piece of bread. And everybody in my family is the same way. I mean, we all feel that pull, And I actually feel really lucky that I was diagnosed finally with an autoimmune disease, because that was the thing that broke it for me. It's like, well, you can die from this or you can just stop eating it. So I stopped eating it, and now it's not food anymore. It's like, forget it. I don't need to go there. And it's really great because, I would have one bite and it would be over for the day. Like, all I could think about was getting more. So I know that addictive feeling. And so I think you're right. I mean, it's everybody. I don't want to single out, the vegetarians or anybody. The entire society around the globe, everybody now at this point is, pretty well addicted to this stuff, and it's what keeps the food system going is growing these grains. We, at this point, like I said, 80% of the food calories that support our current population couldn't be gotten any other way. So we've kind of backed ourselves up against a wall here. There are ways out, which we can talk about, but people get scared, when you start looking at the numbers, because it looks like there's no way to feed us all without continuing to do this. And since it's destroying the planet, you're sort of left falling off the cliff. Like, well, what can we do? Just stand here and wait for the collapse? And I don't actually think so. I think there's a lot of very proactive things we can do that can turn this around. But it is a very scary moment for people, both emotionally and intellectually, because A, we're addicted and we want these substances, but also B, you know, on a larger scale, wow, what's the future going to hold? It looks really scary.
Yeah, we've got a call here, so we're going to go ahead and take it and cross our fingers, okay?
Okay.
Hello, caller.
Hello, caller.
Can you turn your speakers down? Hello.
Hello.
All right, I'm hanging up.
The caller should call back.
I'm hanging up on that one. That's more trouble than it's worth.
That this last part of the discussion reminded me of a chapter in your book where you quote an author, I think, who hypothesized that actually we did not domesticate animals and grains, but actually grains domesticated us, and through addiction, they managed to transform us into slaves. We take care of them, we plant their seeds everywhere around the world, we water them, we feed them, and we help their fundamental goal, i.e. survival and spreading of the species.
Yeah, that's an idea that I got from Michael Pollan's book, which, I mean, it was a different way to look at it for me. And I think that it's actually true in that regard. You can look at it like, well, we did this incredible thing to plants and animals. But if you look across nature, I mean, everything is a symbiotic relationship. Every species changes other species. And ultimately, you know, they work together. They're interdependent. And I think of some species like the acacia ant and the acacia ant tree. And without their ants, the trees die because the ants perform all these incredible functions for them. And likewise, the trees give the ants food and shelter. So without one without the other, they both are dead. But with each other, you know, they change their genomes more and more so that they're completely dependent on each other. And I think that's basically what we've done with this very, very small cohort of plants and animals. And it is very small. I mean, the vast majority of plants want nothing to do with this. And most animals in the world are perfectly content without, you know, signing up to this project with humans. But the few that have done it have been wildly successful. And the example, of course, is wolves versus domestic dogs, where in the United States anyway, there are fewer than 4,000 wolves. But there are 50 million dogs in this country.
Mm-hmm.
So the dogs that went ahead and said, sure, let's hitch our fortunes together, yeah, it worked. I mean, half of them get mm-hmm. Christmas presents. I mean, they live better mm-hmm. lives than plenty of people in third world countries. And I speak here of my dog, mm-hmm. who was completely spoiled and, you know, sleeps on mm-hmm. my bed and has a couch to herself and God knows what all. But it worked, you know. And you can look at it the same way from the perspective of wheat or corn. You know, what did they do? Well, they offered us this little happy hit in our brains. And in exchange, we ripped up the prairies. We pulled down most of the forests. And we turned it over to wheat and corn. So, you know, from a species perspective, like, they got what they wanted. And they conquered the world.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I wanted to talk a little bit about the ideology behind vegetarianism and see if we can't deconstruct some of the most common arguments that are used. I mean, you mentioned earlier on that, you know, you noticed that, you know, everything eats everything else in this life, you know, right from the bacteria up to, you know, lions and tigers and bears, and then humans are just an extension of that. So, I mean, vegetarians have to admit that, like, as you saw, your chickens and ducks ate the slugs and the other insects, and then in the wild, something would be eating those chickens and ducks, and then on up. So, I mean, are there vegetarians who accept that as a natural cycle, and that humans are involved in that? And is their problem really only that the way animals are treated by humans? I mean, if we could get rid of factory farming and the abuses and cruelty that are involved there, would all vegetarians turn around and say, okay, as long as we can do it naturally, then we're cool with that?
You know, I think there's a wide range of viewpoints on this. So it's I don't know that I can speak for everyone who is in that world. So what I would say is there's definitely people who, you know, the real issue is that animals are tortured in factory farms. And I think that's something we can all agree to. It's just horrendous on every level, and it needs to stop. And that should be something that we can all work together on, right? I don't know anybody who can defend these practices. I've just never met a single soul who thought it was okay once they understood what was going on. These are sentient beings, and they're just subjected to horrible things. And, you know, this doesn't need to happen. So on that level, one would hope we could all get together and work. But, you know, if you go to the different websites and read the journals and everything, especially more the vegans, I think, than the vegetarians, and they really hate the idea of, quote, happy meat. I mean, they, for them, and this would have been me, you know, at the time, any human use of animals was wrong, that was always going to be domination. So, you know, I used to have a button, animals are not ours to use, wear, or experiment on, and that I'm still against animal experimentation. I do have a leather jacket. So I changed my mind on that. It was actually kind of a funny moment because I'd been eating meat for a few years and it suddenly occurred to me, oh my God, if I'm eating them, I might as well wear them. So I let myself lust after a leather jacket finally, and I got one. So, all right, that's my big admission. I have a leather coat. I love my leather coat. Anyway, evil me, I know, it's terrible. But it was like, look, really, what's going to happen to the skin? I mean, we should be using every part of the animal.
Absolutely.
I mean, we should. We should be making soap out of some of it, you know? Like, we should be using the hide. We should be using the feathers, should be pillows. I mean, there's a use to be put. You know, we can make musical instruments out of the sinews. Like, all the things people have done with every part of the animal. And I don't know, whatever. So that's an aside. But yes, and so I think that there's this range. There's definitely people who would say, you know, if we can get rid of factory farming, I don't have a problem with the rest of it. And I think those are people who are a little more realistic about the nature of life. They personally don't want to participate, and they feel like, well, if I eat these foods instead of those, there's no death. And that's the point where I think they're fooling themselves. But, you know, it makes them happy. I don't really care. You know, like, you just do what you're going to do. There's only so many times you can have this discussion with people as individuals. And then you've got the more militant people, and again, this would have been me, who just say any way that humans ever use animals is wrong, that we don't have a right, that's seen as a question of rights. And to me, it's not a question of rights, it's a question of reality, that there's no way out of it. There's nothing you can eat that does not ultimately depend on dead plants and animals. And you might as well accept that so you can do it well. And that was the realization that I had to come to.
I suppose those kind of people would ascribe a value to different types of life on the planet. Yeah, I mean, plants, microorganisms, even small insects and stuff aren't as sentient or aren't as important or don't have as much value as a cow or a pig or... I'm pretty sure that's the way they see things, because what other way is it for them to rationalize it in their minds? If they're eating vegetables and involves killing animals, then they must ascribe a value judgment to bigger animals.
And the broccoli doesn't cry or shout or, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Well, that was certainly what I believed. And it's kind of an argument that you'll see over and over, is that there are some animals that have nerves that are like human nerves. Therefore, we know that they experience pain. And because they can suffer, that's the dividing line. The problem with this argument is that, as far as I can tell from the research that I've done and just from experiencing the world, every single living thing loves its life. And I used to draw that line too, but I don't anymore, because you're making a hierarchy. You're saying the creatures that are like me in this very specific way, they're the ones that count. And to me, now, I think, why do they have to be like me for them to count? Every living creature loves its life and deserves respect. There's like, I don't want to live in that hierarchy anymore. And I thought that by doing that, I was the person who was overthrowing those hierarchies, but I just made a new one. And it was still based around human beings and what we think is important. And as it turns out, of course, bacteria communicate all the time. I mean, they send each other incredible amounts of information. That's why we have a problem with these, quote, superbugs, is because every antibiotic we make, they outwit us. And they're able to communicate. Every single bacteria can communicate with every other bacteria. They're really just one species, bacteria. They're fascinating creatures. But they can talk to each other. And, you know, almost overnight, they can spread around the globe. Okay, this is the new antibiotic that the humans have come up with, and this is how you fight it. And so you have resistance almost right away. And that's why now it's only been, what, two generations of antibiotics, and we're running out. you know, because they're smarter than we are. They're outwitting us, and they're communicating about it. So that's bacteria, and then you get to plants, and plants do incredible things. The more you find out about plants, they communicate, they help each other. If one plant in the community is being attacked by insects, the other plants will send insecticides through their roots and try to help that other plant fend off whatever the attacker is. They'll tell each other, like if there's a deer or a bear in the woods and they brush up against some plant, that plant will tell all the others in the neighborhood, hey, there's a big creature walking by, stiffen up a little bit, you're going to need some help. And so then all the other plants will, you know, do whatever it is they do to get a little stiffer so they can, you know, in case they get bumped up against by a great big bear. Where I live in the redwood forest, there are actually albino redwoods, and they can't make chlorophyll. Yeah, so they're not green. They're actually kind of a pale white color. The only reason they're alive, I mean, they can't photosynthesize, right? The only reason they're alive is because the other redwoods feed them. So they never will reach, you know, the huge height of the real redwoods. They're stunted. But they're alive, and they can live a good long time. But it's because the other plants in their community send them nutrients. That's the only way they're alive. And plants do these kinds of things all the time with each other.
That's amazing.
They fight each other for space. Yeah, they help each other when they want to. They create incredibly diverse communities as well. They call plants that are needed to come. And nobody knows how they do it, but they do it. So there are seeds that arrive, and it's not random, but like how do the seeds know to land there? And they don't have propellers. They don't have arms and legs. How do they fall exactly where they're needed? The best book on this is called The Lost Language of Plants, and it's by Stephen Gruner. And this book, it will blow your mind, the things that plants do. But by the time you're done, you can't say, oh, plants aren't really alive. They're not really sentient. They don't really feel things. They are as alive as me or you. The only thing they can't do is get up and run. But on every other level, oh, yeah. And, they're, you know, again, they are the people who are helping keep this planet alive. You know, without them, they are the ones that can turn sunlight into matter. That's an incredible miracle. Without them, it's over. You know, we wouldn't be here. So plants are fabulous. And this is why so many indigenous cultures have this concept of trees or other kinds of plants as our elders. You know, they'll call them, you know, our grandparents, our grandmothers, our grandfathers. And if you need help, you can go talk to them. And people around the world believe this, and they believe it because they experience it. You can talk to the trees and ask them for help. And if you are humble and you really are in need, the idea is they will speak to you. And I think for most of human history, we had that ability. That's an amazing thing. It sounds kind of out there, I guess, for some people, but I mean, it's just story after story about how the plants have helped us. And when you talk to the curanderos and whoever the traditional healers are around the world, so how do you know this is the plant for this disease or this condition? And over they say the same thing. Well, the plants tell us. The plants say this is what they're for. When you ask them, this is what they say. That is the universal answer around the globe. Like, that's
and
amazing
now,
to me.
Now that you are talking about plants also, could you describe a little bit how they defend themselves? You had a great explanation about lectins, and there's something that people don't often know about. You know, plants can't run away from you, but they do have a defense mechanism, and they don't want to eat, or we're not meant to eat them and digest them. Can you explain how the process goes? And
sure. Yeah, most seeds are not really edible. So this includes nuts. It includes grain. Those are all seeds. So to make them edible, we have to do all kinds of things to them, like cook them. You can't eat raw wheat. I mean, you can try if you want. You're going to get really sick. So, I mean, if you need to experiment, go ahead, but it's kind of pointless. We already know what will happen. So cooking is the first thing we do to make plants edible. And the reason that we have to do that is because they defend their babies. You know, when they create a seed, it comes coated with all kinds of protective things that make them inedible, that will make us sick if we eat them. The point is that, you know, just like a mother bear protects her children, the mother plant, the father plant, you know, they're protecting their babies too, and they do it by coating the plants, the seeds, with all kinds of substances that will either irritate or out and out kill you. And so one of these substances is lectins. You've got all kinds of anti-nutrients, and anti-nutrients is a word that means when you try to eat it, you know, as it moves through your digestive tract, those anti-nutrients will bind to minerals. So it's worse than eating nothing. You know, it sucks, sucks nutrition out of your body on the way out. And this is the plant's way of saying, well, you can eat my babies, but you're going to suffer for it. In fact, you may not be able to reproduce yourself if you keep eating these plant babies. You better leave us alone. And soy, of course, is a great example. Soy comes with all kinds of anti-nutrients, but a big problem with soy is the phytoestrogens. So these are substances that mimic human estrogen. So it looks a lot like the estrogens that we have in our bodies, but they're a little bit different. And so they're similar enough that your body thinks it's estrogen, and the phytoestrogens will actually fill up the estrogen receptors on your cells. So you think you've got enough estrogen, you don't, because it doesn't actually behave like human estrogen does, but it's close enough. So by mimicking human estrogen, the plant is able to plug your estrogen receptors. Now you don't actually have enough estrogen, which means you're not going to be able to reproduce. And this is why, you know, soy is linked to all of these terrible reproductive conditions, like, you know, like breast cancer and other kinds of cancer in the reproductive organs. I mean, my well, my sister was also a vegan for a long time, and she ended up with terrible endometriosis from eating soy and ended up having to have a hysterectomy. That is soy's way of fighting back. Yeah, you can eat me, but that's the end of it. You know, your line ends here. You eat too much soy, it's over. So soy, I really, really caution people against soy very strongly.
Yeah. And soy has been the staple of a vegetarian vegan diet for all this time.
Mm-hmm.
It's really tragic when you think about it.
It's ghastly stuff. It's not edible. And some of the researchers will say point blank, these are not foods, these are drugs.
Mm. Well, this is the paradox, isn't it? The amount of work that goes into backbreaking labor, as you said earlier, to grow, say, grains. Well, you've got to clear the land. You've got to grow it. It needs a lot of attention. Then it's not even edible yet. You need to harvest it, process it, cook it. Now you're ready. On the one hand, it's a drug. Yeah, go on.
And even then, you've still got lectins in a lot of it.
Exactly. So. On the one hand, it's a drug, and you're willing to go through all this to get it. And on the other hand, it's killing you.
Mm-hmm.
It's like an anti-cycle of life.
I wonder if vegetarians and vegans would actually, if they were given the choice, if they would prefer if the human race was made extinct and leave the planet to animals and plants.
Well,
what do you think, Jer?
if it came down to it, you know.
I'm sort of sympathetic to that. I see the terrible damage that we're doing. And if we disappeared tomorrow, I think the planet would still be okay. We're going to reach a tipping point past which it wouldn't. I would prefer other things. I think that, you know, this is our home too. And if we would just stop destroying it, I think it would be okay. Mm-hmm. And I don't think this is our nature to do this. I think we've created a terrible combination of social and political forces that are leading to this. And there are people in charge. You know, there is a power structure, there are some people in charge and a lot of people who are dispossessed. So it's not human nature. And I don't believe that this is, you know, our genes making us do this or, you know, our evolutionary history. Because for 2.5 million years, we lived on this planet just fine. You know, we were participants. And you can look at the first art we ever made and you can see that we had awe and thanksgiving for the creatures that gave us life. And in fact, we were so compelled by that awe and thanksgiving that we figured out how to do art, which is pretty amazing. You know, like that we were so compelled to say thank you that we learned how to draw. You know, we had to express it somehow. And so that's where I come from. I think that is more in our bodies and in our brains, is that awe and that drive to participate that's been, it's so hard to get to now, you know, because we're so alienated. But I'm sympathetic to the urge, at least emotionally, to say, God, if we could just get rid of humans, it would all be okay. Because I think pretty much every other species on the planet would probably heave a sigh of relief. You know, they're under assault. They're fighting a war, and they're losing.
Apart from the dogs.
Is losing, you know.
Yeah.
Apart from the dogs. Well, people do behave like a virus.
Right now, yes, we are behaving that way.
Now,
yeah.
the thing that... And you mentioned it runs to your book. I mean, you have this overview of history, let's say the last 10,000 years, since the dawn of agriculture. And people can look at that and go, well, that's a long time. I mean, it's, you know, your insights are great, but wow, we're locked in this. You know, this is all we know, agricultural civilization. But there is hope, surely, in the fact that the way we are, a very genetic blueprint, is actually far older. As you say, it's like developed over 2 million years of a completely different way of living.
Lauren Cordain, who's an expert in Paleolithic nutrition, he uses this image of a football field. So that's an American football field. I don't know how big a European soccer field is, but anyway, great big field, right? And so he uses, that's the entire history of humans on Earth. So it's 2.5 million years. That's represented by that field. And it's the last half a yard. That's where agriculture begins. So we were on, you know, this planet all that time, and it's only that very last half a yard where the destruction begins. And then the very last 1/5 of an inch, that's the industrial age. So it's a really short period of time in terms of who we are, just biologically speaking, agriculture. It's a really new activity.
And in your book, you explain also that we should be cautious with the illusion of going back to hunter-gatherer diet by solely eating modern meat, modern breeds, and modern breeds of vegetables and fruits, like hunter-gatherers did or might have done, because you emphasize that between the current modern breeds, high on sugar, very lean for the meat, and rustic old breeds, there is almost nothing in common.
Yeah, you know, a lot of people who take up sort of fruitarian diets, they think they can live on raw fruit.
Yeah.
They can't. They're going to get really sick. I mean, it's pretty sad to watch. But they don't understand that it doesn't exist in nature. These are, you know, highly, highly hybridized, you know, forms of food. And what we did, you know, by domesticating things like even apples or berries, we took out a whole bunch of the anti-nutrients, which were very bitter. Wild apples are basically inedible. I mean, they're so bitter that you just kind of gag when you bite one. So we took out all the anti-nutrients and made them sweeter and sweeter and sweeter. And so you're eating way more sugar than somebody would have had access to even 10,000 years ago. And I don't think they realize that what they're eating, you know, they make all kinds of claims about, well, this is the natural human diet, but that didn't exist. That's only been around for a few thousand years. And, you know, it was a huge amount of human effort went into making that edible for you. So, I mean, it just, that kind of fairy tale just really falls apart. Yeah, did I answer your question?
I have another question, trying to understand better the vegetarian myth. I have to confess, for 11 years I was a vegetarian. Nobody's perfect. And during this period of my life, one of my main arguments, and I believed in it, was that, okay, to produce 1 kilogram of veggie, you need, say, 1 acre. And to produce 1 kilogram of meat, you need 10 times the surface. So with all those people starving to death, vegetarianism is the way to go. It's a better use of the available soil. So is there any flaw in this reasoning?
Yeah, so this is why I called it the vegetarian myth and not the vegetarian lie, okay? There is a grain of truth in this. And the truth is that, yes, if you have factory farming, you need a tremendous amount of corn to feed those cows. And so the argument is, well, that corn should go to humans instead, which, you know, on the surface makes sense. It's a simple argument, and I believed it myself for many years. This was the beginning of the whole sort of vegetarian ethic as it developed across popular culture, and it really came from Frances Moore LePay's book, Diet for a Small Planet. She was the one who really put forward that argument, and it's really gotten taken up. And I understand why people believe it. I mean, it sort of makes sense on the surface. But you need to go down a couple more layers, and the whole thing basically falls apart. So the first problem is, why are we feeding corn to cows? I mean, it doesn't actually make any sense. It's not their native diet. It makes them really sick, in fact. They can only live on those feedlots for, you know, maybe 2 months. After that point, they literally 100% of them get sick because it's not the food they were meant to eat. For one problem is it's way too acid. They're supposed to eat grass, right? Mm-hmm. But when you feed them grain, it turns their, they have four stomachs. The rumen becomes way too acid. And literally, it eats holes in their stomachs. So then they get all this blood poisoning because all this, you know, half-digested whatever with all the bacteria is getting into their bloodstream, which, of course, creates liver disease because the poor liver is trying to clean the blood. So all of these animals go to slaughter very sick. So it's not what they were meant to eat. And the only reason that we're doing this, and this is where it gets more complicated, so 1950 is really the beginning of factory farming. World War II, you know, they had already figured out the Haber-Bosch process in World War I. By World War II, they're cranking out all this nitrogen to use to make...
Just a note, the Haber-Bosch process is the way to produce nitrogen industrially from oil products, right?
Exactly, yes. And in World War I, the German route to the... They were using bat guano or seagull droppings or something that were in, I think, Argentina. There were huge caves of this, and that's what they were using to make munitions. And the route for the Germans got cut off. I think by the, you know, the English and the United States or whatever, they couldn't get to it anymore. So the chemists were working double time to try to figure out how can we make nitrogen ourselves so that we can keep fighting this war, and they did figure it out. Franz Haber was the guy who did it. So, and it's actually interesting to read about Franz Haber, what happened to him, because he was a Jew. Ultimately, he was killed by the Nazis, even though he created this thing that they really needed. You know, it ended very, very badly for him. You know, being involved in the scientific world. And his wife actually committed suicide because of what he had done. He created mustard gas and some of the really toxic gases that were used to kill people on the front, and she couldn't stand it. She was also a scientist, and she killed herself. She just couldn't, it was unbearable to her what this man was doing. But, you know, having done all these wonderful war services, he was then put to death by his own country for being Jewish. I mean, it's like this story just has no good ending anywhere that you look at it. His son also committed suicide, which is just completely heartbreaking. Like, the next generation still was a mess. All of this just death and destruction, right? I mean, it just, it's the saddest, saddest story. Anyway, this was who invented the Haber-Bosch process. So, yes. So by World War II, they've got it down to a, really down to a science. They're cranking out all this nitrogen. The World War ends, so what do you do with all these, you know, munitions factories? Well, in the United States, they turn them into fertilizer factories. And by 1950, the Green Revolution really kicks off. So now they've got all these, you know, all this nitrogen fertilizer just pouring out of these factories. It all, of course, ends up in Iowa and Nebraska and, you know, the Midwest, what used to be a prairie, and it's dumped all over the place, and this mountain of corn is created with this fertilizer. There is so much corn, it's got nowhere to go. And at that point, corn becomes so cheap on the market that it makes economic sense to take cows off of their native habitat, off of their free diet of grass. Grass just grows, right? And put them basically in cities. I mean, they're living on concrete floors and horrible buildings, totally crowded conditions. You're packing them into a city, essentially, and feed them this bizarre stuff that they're not meant to eat, and that is corn. And it's only because corn got so cheap. Up to that point, factory farming, it had never existed. I mean, it couldn't exist until corn was that cheap. So the only reason we have factory farming is because of the Green Revolution. It's because of the Haber-Bosch process. So now what happens in the Midwest every year here in the United States, we have this thing called the Farm Bill. And the government gives out these subsidies to farmers. There are six corporations that essentially control the world food supply. And because they have a monopoly, they're able to drive the cost of grain below the cost of production. So no matter how hard these poor farmers work, they cannot keep their heads above water. They cannot turn a profit because it's a monopoly system, right? So the grain is super, super cheap on the market. It costs them more than that to actually produce it. So now next year they have to produce even more to try to make a couple pennies more by producing more, but that just drives the price down even further. So every year the farmers are in a worse situation. Now, instead of breaking up these monopolies, what the U.S. government does, handmaiden to the corporations, they do this thing called the Farm Bill, and they hand out subsidies. So they'll give the farmers just enough money to stay in business, right, and they do nothing about the fact that this is a monopoly system around the globe. In other countries, and, in fact, in the past, in this country, we had a totally different system. This was not how food was produced, and we didn't let this happen. But, of course, all of that got deregulated under Ronald Reagan in the 1980s, and now farmers are just in this horrible position. The number one cause of death for farmers in this country and in India is suicide, which is very grim, right? It doesn't matter whether you're in a really rich country or a really poor country or somewhere in between. The farmers are in the same condition. They are serfs, and there's no way out, right? And so they end up killing themselves. I mean, it's just horrible. Anyway, that's why we have factory farming, okay? It's because the corn is so cheap. And the reason it's so cheap is because of the monopoly and because of the fossil fuel. And that's the only reason that that factory farming exists. So the answer is not to, and the answer is certainly to stop factory farming. I think we can all agree. But the answer is not to stop consuming that beef for that reason. There are plenty of good reasons not to eat that factory farmed beef. But you're not going to feed hungry people by doing that. Okay, the corn is not being produced so that cows can eat it. It's being overproduced because of the monopoly, because the farmers have to produce more every year to try to make a little bit more money so they can pay their mortgages. Okay, that's the only reason all that corn is flooding out of the Midwest every year. It ends up feeding cows, but cows are not demanding it. Okay, the people who are demanding it is, you know, this terrible market system where they can't even make a profit on what they're producing. That's why there's a surplus of corn. So whether or not you and I eat that beef is completely irrelevant. Those farmers are going to have to keep overproducing as long as this political and economic system has them in that kind of a headlock. Okay.
Which is based
and
on...
then what the other thing that... Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say it's based on greed, ultimately.
Absolutely, yeah. And we're going to have to stand down those powerful systems in order to change this. You know, you and I withdrawing from, you know, that supermarket beef is not going to make a single jot of difference. Now, the other half of that equation is, oh, we should give the corn to the people who can't afford to buy food. Okay, so this is a whole other problem. Why should people in Cambodia or India be dependent on a rich country like the United States for food? I mean, it's kind of insane. They should be able to support themselves. And in fact, they know how to support themselves. And if you talk to food activists around the world, they'll say the same thing over and over. We know how to feed our people. We need to be left alone to do that. Get your corporations out of our country. Because what happens is those corporations, having bought this incredibly cheap grain that is subsidized by the U.S. government, they do what's called agricultural dumping. So they'll go to a poor country like the Philippines, like Mexico, like wherever, and they flood the market with this cheap grain, and they drive the local farmers out of business, destroy the local economies, and then what happens is these people who were self-sufficient and had land and had a culture and a community are forced off their land. They lose everything, and they have to. Then there's this flood of refugees, economic refugees, into the cities, and that's why you have the swollen misery of places like Mexico City. It's because all of those farmers were pushed off their land by exactly this process. And then you've got people who think they care about the world saying that this is somehow a good thing. Every time you do agricultural dumping, you are creating just more human misery by driving those farmers out of business. They don't need our cheap grain. That's the last thing you want to do, is dump cheap grain around chronically hungry people. They should be able to support themselves. The only reason they can't is precisely because of cheap American grain. So they've got this completely backwards, the vegetarians, when they say, oh, that should go to feed hungry people. No, it shouldn't, actually. We should leave them alone because they know how to feed themselves.
Is it possible if all of the land that has been given over to growing grains across the U.S., for example, if all of that was given back to cattle to eat grass, would it produce enough meat to feed the population in the absence of most cereals?
I can't actually find a reliable statistic on that. I do know that we are on vast overshoot, and there's no way around that. We're going to have to face the fact that there are way too many people on the planet, but that doesn't have to be grim. There are actually ways to fix that. In fact, the only way to fix it, I think, is actually to support human rights. But we can talk about that in a minute. This point that you're making is a really good one. In many, many places, given enough rainfall, you could take the same acre of land and you could produce one cow's worth of beef, except you could do it in two really different ways. So the first way is what's been happening, and it's kind of insane. You take this land that's you know, a nice lush grassland that includes all sorts of plants and animals on it. So you've got, you know, ground-dwelling birds, you've got small mammals, you've got reptiles, you've got amphibians. Nearby is a stream that's really healthy that has fish. You've got a water table that recharges every year. It's life, and it could go on forever until the sun burns out. It's all good. Okay, then you come in with a tractor, you rip it all up, you kill all the animals, you push everybody off it, you bare the soil, which means you're destroying it, and then you put corn on it. So you grow an acre of corn on that land. You're destroying the water table, you destroy the stream, everybody's dead. Okay, you've got this acre of corn, you can take that acre of corn and feed it to one cow. And at the end of the year, you'll have a really sick cow who had a miserable life, but she's fat and she's ready for market, and then she can be fed to humans and make the people sick as well. But that was the amount of beef that was produced, was one cow on that 1 acre from corn. Okay, another scenario, same acre of land. You leave it in grass. All those other creatures live there. You got a healthy water table. The nearby streams are looking good. There's no fossil fuel. You've got a ruminant on it like a cow. This could go on forever. That is a closed loop. Everybody plays a role. At the end of that year, you've got the same amount of beef from that cow, but it's really good beef. She had a good life. That, and the life of that place, that biotic community, is completely intact, and you can feed the same number of humans off it. This is true across many, many, many miles of land, square miles of land, where there's enough rainfall. You have this scenario where you can do one or the other, and we've been doing this totally insane thing on agriculture and factory farming. And at the end of the day, you know, scenario two is the one that just makes sense on every level, but that's not the one we're doing. But it's the same amount of food. And I think that's really what you're asking, is that in many places, yes, you will have the same amount of food. But it's healthy food, it's humane food, and it's food that is participating in a very resilient cycle of continuing life. So I don't know why we're doing the other one. I mean, just on the surface, it makes no sense. I mean, I get that there are political and economic reasons that are psychopathic underneath it all, but
exactly.
Even just on a surface level, like, what are these people doing? This is crazy. So in many places, yes, that is the only way forward, is, you know, to return the grasslands, let the prairies return.
You suggested that this is a matter of policy, that this is a choice that is made, and it's controlled by a monopoly. I mean, do they have even half of the sort of insight or oversight that you're sharing with us today? Is it willingly being done? I mean, I cannot imagine the board of directors of Monsanto sitting down to eat anything that they sell.
No,
to people.
They don't. Well,
yeah.
it was revealed that in Monsanto cafeteria, they sell organic food.
Yeah.
They only sell organic food. And everybody, apparently in government as well, in Congress, the restaurant in Congress or wherever, where they all go to eat, it's all organic food. Yet they're all signing bills,
you know,
and passing bills bills into law that allows, you know, gives the crap to people, you know.
Congress also, they have a single-payer health care plan, all the members of Congress.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the irony in that, they're shutting down the government now because they hate Obamacare so much, but they get a single-payer health care system their whole lives.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, no, I don't know. The whole thing is it's just completely psychopathic, isn't it? I have no explanation on an emotional level as to what these people's motivation is. They have it highly rationalized, clearly, and they're certainly being rewarded. I mean, they're making so much money doing this, but there's got to be something they love.
Psychopathy and money. That's their god. That's the bottom line for them, and nothing else matters. And like I said, they look after themselves and screw the people, you know.
And it's really sad, because you mentioned earlier how basically the majority of human beings are not for that, are not in that mindset. They don't want to destroy. They don't want war. They don't want the system.
They don't naturally dominate.
And yeah, exactly. They don't want to destroy. I mean, they would probably follow some kind of, you know, healthy, harmonious lifestyle if they were left to choose. But the problem is, here you have, and correct me if I'm wrong, Lear, but here you have people who would be well-intentioned to begin with. Say it's, well, some psychologists say it's 1% of the population are genetically psychopaths. Imagine that mm-hmm. a majority of those are in power and are making these decisions. And you have these people who are willing to actually paying for their poison because they go to the supermarket and pay for that. And then they have to depend on the pharmaceuticals, you know, and I don't want to get all conspiratorial and stuff, but it really looks like that, doesn't it? I mean, it's just a tiny little group of people who are making these laws, making poor countries buy their own seeds. And if you don't buy the patented seeds, you're screwed forever. And, you know, it's just a cycle. And if only people could actually choose for once and decide and realize that it's really a handful of these leaders that are, or, you know, whatever, the ones behind this monopoly.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. It's bad out there.
Well, that little piece of history you gave about the explosion of the use of fertilizers after the Second World War is fascinating. So World War II ends, and they have all these munitions left over. So what do we do with them? I can imagine at the time it's a convenient, you know, solution to a temporary problem. But look what it's led to, one thing after the next. And we've got the situation today where the topsoil is so shot that the grains that were already bad enough, so they tell us, can't grow. So here's our genetically enhanced version. Take this, and this will solve the food hunger crises that were caused by, you know, their predecessors. So it's like we've gone further and further into this sort of cul-de-sac.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so in terms of the big picture, what can people do? We don't know, but maybe there are some solutions for those of us who do care and who do want to improve our own lives and the lives of flora and fauna around us. Mm-hmm. So maybe we can get into some solutions. How do you... I think you've described yourself as a farmer. Do you farm at home or?
Yeah, I have 5 acres and I have goats, and I'm going to be getting chickens and ducks very soon. And I have a great big dog.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, and a garden. So yeah, and I haven't lived here very long, or this place I just moved to, but I'm going to be putting in some fruit trees as well. So yeah, and before that, I've also lived on other smaller farms where we did chickens and eggs and other stuff too. So I have certainly raised my own food. I get the idea, you know, the cost of all of this, both
mm-hmm.
emotionally
yeah.
and economically. It's a lot. You know, people don't realize what goes into it. But anyway, solutions. Yes, I do think that there are some, both on the big picture and on the smaller picture. So on the very biggest picture, global warming is, you know, coming down. And by some estimates, 400,000 people have already died due to planetary climate chaos, and this is only going to get worse, right? So
mm-hmm.
the best thing that we can do for our planet is to take the trashed out grasslands that have been destroyed by agriculture and let the prairies come home. We just let that grass come back. If we were to do that on only 75% of the world's destroyed prairies, within 15 years, we could sequester all of the carbon, all of it, that's been released since the beginning of the industrial age. That's an incredible statistic, but you have to remember what prairies do. Those grasses are really good at building soil. That's their main job. And the building block, of course, is carbon. So they suck the carbon out of the air, and they build soil, and now it's sequestered. In fact, just this morning, I was reading a fabulous article about all the abandoned farmland in Russia. You know, the farmers have left for the cities, and the farms just lie there. And, of course, what happens is they turn back into either prairie or forest pretty quickly. And somebody did the calculations on the amount of carbon that has been sucked back into the soil because people stopped farming in Russia. And it's just an astronomical amount. Something like, I don't know, 10% of all of their industrial carbon has now been resequestered just by leaving it alone. It was
mm-hmm.
something huge. Don't quote me on that exact number, but it was really stunning. And so right there. I mean, they didn't even do it on purpose. And, you know, it started to happen. So that's our best hope. the United States, we could do this even just east of the Mississippi River. In the first year, the United States could become a carbon sequestering nation. That's a really extraordinary statistic, but it's all true. And just remember what prairies do. They build soil, right? That's their main job. So that's one spot of hope. Go ahead.
You mentioned that we're going to have to face the fact that there are too many people on the planet. Is that hard and fast in terms of a problem?
Yes. Well, for me, I don't see this as... Some people are very terrified to take this on as a concept, to the point where they're just in denial about it. But I think we should face it squarely, because the solutions that help the planet are also really crucial for human rights. So it's not humans against the planet, it's humans with the planet. That's the only thing that gets us to the world that we need. The number one thing you can do to drop the birth rate around the globe, the number one thing, is teach a girl to read. It is that simple. When women and girls have that much more power over their lives, they choose to have fewer children. The number one thing is simply educating girls, just giving them a basic education. When girls are educated, the entire community does better. They call it the multiplier effect. Because when girls are better, young women do better. And when young women do better, their children do better. And then the whole community does better. And so it just goes round in this circle that is lifting everybody out of poverty. But women around the globe have very little control over the uses to which, you know, dominating men put our bodies. So as it stands now, somewhere around half of all pregnancies are either unwanted or unplanned. All we have to do is give women control over their bodies, and the birth rate will be cut in half. That, to me, is extraordinary. And we should care about that anyway, because women are human, and we deserve human rights. And that starts with, you know, no, I don't want to have sex. No, I don't want to have a baby. No, I want to get an education right now. Like, that's so basic to anybody's life.
Mm-hmm.
And in countries where they've done this, it's worked. And the really incredible example is Iran, because this is the country that's controlled by, you know, essentially a religious theocracy, very conservative. But they crunched the numbers, and they saw they had a birth rate that was pretty much the biological limit, upper limit. And they realized that within a generation, there wasn't going to be, like, anywhere to sit or stand, let alone, like, water to drink or food. And they had a problem. So what are we going to do? So they had a huge meeting with everybody who cared about the issue, and they developed a multi-pronged approach. But at the very center of it was this idea that you had to educate girls and you had to give women some control over their lives. So they offered birth control to everybody. You had to, if you were going to get a marriage license, you had to go to a birth control class. And it was free. It was freely available. And in the cities, they set up little, what they called health houses, like pretty much on every street corner you could go and get free birth control. But it had to be culturally appropriate, because if it was just for birth control, nobody was going to go. So they had to pretend that you could go there and also get your blood pressure checked or whatever, you know, get a blood draw for cholesterol. It wasn't true. I mean, everybody kind of knew what it was for, but it worked. So people actually used it. And then in rural areas, they had mobile units that went from village to village and just talked to everybody, you know. And then they had, in every neighborhood, they had women who signed up to do this, sort of who were elders in the community, who were trained in, you know, different methods of birth control and whatnot. And they just went house to house and talked to everybody. Do you want birth control? Do you understand birth control? What are your questions? What can we get for you? And so that was really huge, was just to give everybody access. A real turning point was when they got the religious community on board, and they got the big religious leaders to put out a statement saying that there was nothing in the Quran against having a vasectomy or having a tubal ligation. So it was fine. If you have enough children and you can't provide for more, that's really important to God, and you're allowed to say you're done. And so, like, literally overnight, men were lining up around the block to get vasectomies because they didn't want to have 12 children either. You know, like, it was their lives as well that were being impacted by this. So that made a huge difference. And then they had a whole conversation going across the country where they got some of the soap opera writers and the TV drama, you know, the writers of these shows, to include talks about birth control and family size in the stories. So you would have, you know, a younger woman talking to her mom or something. Oh, I don't know, we're going to get married. What do I do about birth control? And they would have a whole talk about it, just very openly. So they made the conversation possible for everyone. And they had billboards about it. So it was a huge public education thing. They made dramatic efforts to increased female literacy. So the girls in school, it went from 25% to 75% within 5 years, which is incredible. And so keeping girls in school, like everybody understood this was important. And then there were, if you had one or two children as a couple, you got all kinds of really good benefits from the state. You could get like a food stamp thing for food and various other daycare stuff. If you've got three children, then all the benefits went away. They didn't penalize you, but you didn't get any good stuff. So there definitely was, you know, a little bit of a stick involved with the carrot. But, you know, it wasn't like China where they had these just god-awful human rights horrors. It was just, oh, well, no more goodies. And all of that together within 5 years, their birth rate dropped to replacement levels. I mean, these are things, again, that we should care about anyway. People deserve to control their reproductive lives. Girls deserve to stay in school. Nobody should be getting married at age 12. And that's all they did. They changed all of that very quickly, which also shows that people's desire for children is really plastic. You know, it was actually very malleable. And when presented with facts and other alternatives, they stopped having 12 children. Nobody actually wanted to do that with themselves. So it worked. And it worked in a really beautiful way that gave everybody more power and control and more human rights. So this is why I say it's not humans against the planet. It's humans with the planet is the only way we're going to go forward.
Yeah. Leah, allow me to move one step backward about overpopulation. In your book, you explain that since the 19th century, basically, we've been running on phantom carrying capacity. We manage to have such a huge human population, 7 billion maybe, because indirectly we're eating oil. Can you so even if we move back now, transform all the monocrop annual farming land into grazing prairies, we won't be able to feed those 7 billion people because they come out from a phantom carrying capacity. Can you expect?
Well, she just offered an explanation that, or a solution to that, which is essentially women stop having so many babies so that people who die off are greater than children who are born. So over a certain period of time, you'll have a population decline. That's a long-term goal.
Yeah, it would take 2 or 3 generations, but it could absolutely be done. We don't have to have mass starvation and, you know, these terrible dystopian movies, you know, Mad Max or whatever. We all have these terrible ideas about, you know, the collapse. It doesn't have to be that way. We could take control of the situation, you know, as a society, as a species, and decide that, you know, for all these really good reasons, nobody needs to have this many children, and we'll just have 1 or 2 each, and that's it. And very naturally, the population would simply decline, and we could once again live in a really sustainable way. So as the human population shrank, the prairies and the forests could return, and we could go back to simply getting our food from inside those living communities rather than imposing ourselves across them. And I think this is a very doable project. I mean, you can see how it would work. And there are countries that have already tried some of these things and seen how successful they are. We just need the political understanding and then the political will to set them in motion. And that's the problem.
Yeah, preceding all of those plans, then we need a revolution.
Yeah, we
do. we can do all these things. We just need this. Oh, okay. But yeah, I get your point. I mean, humans, I mean, we're creative creatures. We come up with solutions. We tried and tested a number of things that have worked. It's just that we have this thing stalking us, you know, where for every step forward, it just wants to drag you back too.
Yeah.
For every country that's moving towards, you know, progressive, relatively secular, understand the value of education, trying to really inform its people. You've got two countries that have been bombed back to the Stone Age, a Taliban type clique take over, and this continues. You know, this is almost like for every, let's say, good missionary that comes out of the West, There are two players out there bombing and taking people and countries back into a medieval existence. I don't know. I have a lot of faith in people and what they can do. But yeah, short of a revolution against this thing, the beast, all the solutions that, I mean, for something like this to really work, it would need to come from the top. right?
We're going to need all the institutions that now control society around the globe to get on board, and they're not. You've got, for instance, the Catholic Church, which can't even wrap its mind around condoms. I mean, it's ridiculous. Yeah. You got men in dresses telling women what to do with their bodies. I mean, it's just completely absurd, right? Yeah. And you know, all
condoms around, right?
Yeah, exactly, right.
switch that around. Be a solution to the Catholic problem.
Yeah,
carry
well,
on. Sorry.
I mean, the worst of them are sort of, you know, they're not, at least they're not reproducing at the top level, but they seem to have everybody else in their thrall. The thing is, that's so funny about the Catholics is that it's that, you know, these really heavily Catholic nations have a negative birth rate. Clearly people are using birth control. I mean, they're obviously using birth control. You know, like, nobody's listening to the Pope. He should just shut up for a while. He should listen to them, you know. But anyway, I mean, I hear your point. There's all these fundamentalists of whatever stripe around the globe, and they control the resources, and they let men control women, and, you know, they control the money, and they control the power structure, and a lot of them are just plain psychopaths, and we've let them. We've rewarded their behavior rather than disallowing it. We reward it. And that's the problem with systems like capitalism and like civilization and like patriarchy. The scum rises, you know, and they get rewarded. They should have been thrown off the ice floe when they were four, and it was clear they weren't going to play well with others no matter what. Or at the very least, not given any power to do anything. You know, we can throw some fruit scraps from the distance, but we don't. Instead, they rule the world. So, I mean, this is why it's so important that you're doing the work you're doing. Your publishing house, you know, you put out your books about psychopaths, and that's why I wrote books. I want people to understand the scale of the problem, the organization of the problem, so that we can talk about real solutions.
And while thinking about it, I'm not sure the solution can come from the top. Well, because as you said, psychopaths are in power, and when you read about psychopathy, one of two main features of this strange psychological profiles is A, the power, the quest for more power, more money, and B, enjoying the suffering of others. And through farming, finally, I realized that they reached those two goals. They've managed to transform the whole population into drug addicts, literally walking deads, who are willing to pay for the drug that destroys them, so they get the money, and they get the suffering of others. So it's from a psychopathic point of view, it's farming is a great plan.
Yeah, it's a pretty perfect system.
Yeah.
But see, the only good thing is that there are always people who do not want to be slaves. You pick the period in history, there's always a resistance.
Yes.
And I have to believe, with all of life at stake, that the resistance will build.
Yeah, and it's a double challenge here. I agree with you. I think if the change comes, it will come from the bottom, from the mass movement, people who have enough of suffering, basically. And there's a double challenge because, A, there's the you need this growing awareness of the system you're living in, this psychopathic dimension, the real nature of your elites. And B, you have to be willing to go beyond your addiction. That is blinding your thinking. That is making you subjective and not seeing things as they are. So there's a double challenge to overcome.
I just wanted to investigate a little theory that I have, and see what you think, Lear, about vegetarians and vegans. And in terms of, as I kind of mentioned earlier on, the way that they seem to have almost a greater affinity for animals than they do for humans, such as the strength of their disgust and their abhorrence at the idea of killing animals and eating them. It's almost I'm just wondering if A, you think there might be an insoluble problem there in terms of a certain number of people on the planet who actually, when it comes down to it, would say animals are more important than humans, and let the humans die and let the animals stay no matter what happens, no matter what solution was presented to them. They would never, ever come around to the idea of killing another animal as being okay. And Yeah, well, maybe that's the first one.
Well, you know, on one level, it doesn't actually matter whether people hold an ideology like that so strongly, because they don't really have any power.
Yeah.
Like, there's nothing they can do with an ideology like that. And honestly, I think the solution is pretty simple. They just need to grow their own food, and they'll see. And that's how I learned. I just tried it myself, and I could see that no matter which way I turned, it dead-ended with a dead animal. You know, and at one point in the slug battle, I just gave up. It was like I couldn't kill them. I didn't know what to do. So I went to the store, and I bought some lettuce and some broccoli instead of growing it. And for one second, it felt like it was a relief. It was like, oh, thank God, I'll just buy it instead. And I stood there literally holding that head of lettuce, and it was this moment of just grow up. Just grow up. It's ridiculous. Do you think the people who made this lettuce didn't kill slugs? Of course they killed insects to get you this lettuce. They probably killed way more. They probably used really horrible chemicals and killed birds and reptiles and mammals as well as just a few slugs. You are so fooling yourself if you think there was not death in every stage of the growing of this lettuce. And it was just, it was a really hard moment, but it was reality. And it was so much better to just face it finally and to stop running from it. It's like, my life depends on death. You just have to stand and face it. So I think that if, you know, there are people who are in that same mindset that I was in, I think that it's just a really simple solution. Grow your own food and you'll see. There's no way out of this, you know.
The reason I thought of that was because the idea that some people, some human beings are slightly different than others, let's say, in some kind of fairly fundamental way that, you know, not everybody's created equal or not everybody's created the same in some way, because I've also noticed that, maybe I'm wrong in this, but I get the impression that some people on a vegetarian diet do a lot better than others.
I think if you're a vegetarian, it's easier than being a vegan, because at least you're getting some animal fats and some of the fat-soluble vitamins. So you can limp along a lot longer on that diet. The vegan is just, you just fall apart. I mean, there's no way around it. But the vegetarians can last longer.
Aren't there examples of healthy vegans?
No. I'm sorry, but there just aren't. You can do it for a while. And, you know, when you're in your 20s, you can get away with pretty much anything. But by the time you're 30, the rubber's going to hit the road. And I will say, for these people, even in their 20s, their bodies were built on animal products. They were not vegan pregnancies. You know, their moms ate animal products. And throughout their childhoods, of course, they ate milk and they had eggs and they had hamburgers. And then, you know, for a few years, they decide they're going to try this. Well, go ahead. But, you know, eventually, you're on drawdown the whole time. I mean, you're just sucking nutrients out of your body, and eventually you run out.
Yeah, there was a case in France, actually, a few years ago, where a mother who had she was a vegan all throughout her pregnancy and beforehand, and while she was breastfeeding the baby eventually died, and they blamed it on her diet and the breast milk and her diet while the baby was before the baby was born. The kind of nutrients that the mother was getting were not sufficient to feed the baby, and then afterwards when she was breastfeeding, it was not sufficient either, and the baby died. And I mean, that was a pretty damning indictment of a vegan diet, you know?
Yeah, these stories pop up in the news occasionally, but it's good to remember that your breast milk is only as good as your nutrition. So if you're not eating a nutrient-dense diet, there's no way to produce that milk. So, yes, I would want to say mother's milk is always best, but in the case of somebody who's a vegan, no, mother's milk is not best. Mother's milk is starvation for that child.
I just wanted to comment on what you said previously. I think there's indeed a lot of hypocrisy in vegetarian build up their good conscience on this hypocrisy as long as they don't see what is beyond the vegetarian product they consume. For cheap, finally, they easily access good conscience. And if they knew what was beyond the broccoli, all the suffering, the destroyed wildlife, fauna and flora, the nitrogen, the fertilizers, and all the death that is involved in this broccoli, they would realize that it's not as rosy as they think. And That reminds me when I was vegetarian, the only meat I was consuming actually when I was going spearfishing. So I was spending hours in the sea trying to get a fish, you know. And it's cold, it's tiring, you get the fish, you kill it, which is not very appealing, and you carry it, you have to eviscerate it, etc., etc. It's a lot of work, and you really feel really bad killing it. And it's as if there's a inversion of values. When you eat the broccoli, you feel good. Okay, I didn't kill any animal. It's all clean. It's all nice. And although you induce a lot of destruction, and on the other side, when you kill a fish by yourself, like a hunter or fisherman, you feel really bad because you face death right in front of your eyes. Although, in this case, that might be the less harmful way of feeding yourself, because ultimately, then the last question, the ultimate question is, okay, it's either him or me, because if I don't eat, I die. You know, if I hit him, he dies. So death cannot be brought out of the equation.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I think you're exactly right. It's a hard moment.
I think vegans and vegetarians really need to realize that by supporting modern agriculture, they are supporting a system that is killing a lot of animals. It's also damaging and ultimately killing a lot of human beings, because by encouraging, by supporting modern agriculture, they're supporting everybody around the world eating grains, which is causing all sorts of modern illnesses and diseases, that is killing a lot of people. And they're also supporting a system, a hierarchy at the top of the pyramid that controls that modern agriculture, that is closely tied to corporations and government and military, that is also killing a lot of people around the world in a very direct way.
Yeah.
You know, so all the way around, they're supporting a very destructive system that kills everybody, ultimately, all forms of life on this planet, from the bottom all the way to the top, if humans are at the top. But
it's not hard to see how, as an ideology, it's attractive for people who care, who are upset with what they see happening,
but
and
who don't
want to do something.
But who don't think.
This is
and
it.
Maybe you can't think.
Yeah, it comes back to how much of the reality are you seeing, Pierre's. But what you said, Pierre, reminds me of that saying, out of sight, out of mind. And I think it applies across the board to everyone. You know, people don't realize where their food comes from, so they don't think about it. And it's not just vegans, vegetarians. Lier, you said yourself a few minutes ago, and I think it sums up your book, for me anyway, the lasting impression is that it's about growing up. And it's not something that will leave you in despair and despondent. It's life-affirming,
mm-hmm.
because you learn some important facts of life,
mm-hmm.
that do give you hope and give you ideas. I mean, we have you here today, and
mm-hmm.
it's great to hear you speaking, because, you know, you've clearly, you're passionate about it.
You've gone through that process.
You've gone through it, and you understand. You see more reality, and you see more potential in people.
Mm-hmm.
You see more solutions.
It's about facing an unpleasant reality, the facts of the reality in which we live and the life that we live, and getting out of your airy-fairy, love and light kind of idealistic way of viewing the world that blocks out a lot of the reality behind the scenes. And that's what growing up's about.
Go ahead. No, you go ahead. You finish.
I just wanted to thank you, actually, because you might not know it, because not everybody will have written to you, but we have thousands of people in our forum, and they actually, probably a few hundreds, have tried to change their diet. And the effect, and the amazing thing is that everybody has autoimmune issues, you know, all kinds of problems, psychological or physical. And the effects have been amazing. I mean, including us, and it's just amazing. And I don't think maybe you know about everybody you're helping with your work. So, you know, maybe people, if you're listening and you haven't read this book, it's called The Vegetarian Myth by Lier Keith, and you really, really should read it. And it's in French too.
Yeah, it's in French. We translated it, and we're very proud of it. We started that about 2 years ago because we are so excited by the book. It's very eye-opening, and I can share a testimony. I was vegetarian for 11 years, as I said, and after those 11 years, I got really sick, and I got 2 brain cancers that are considered the most incurable, phase grade 3 cancers, and it was at the time when I changed diet. And I stopped being a vegetarian, and this problem occurred about 4 years ago, and I'm still alive today, and mortality rate is something like 80%. So well, you cannot make statistics or rules from one isolated case, but I can testify that I think this diet change contributed significantly to my survival and to my good health. So, yeah, thank you for spreading this very important message, I think.
Well, thanks for sharing your story. That's pretty profound. The thing about cancer in particular is, you know, one thing we know for cancer, absolutely true, is that it eats sugar. So if you take all the sugar, and that includes grain because it's really all it is, all the sugar out of your diet, you will simply starve those cancer cells. And this is why cancer is called one of the diseases of civilization. Hunter-gatherers don't get cancer. It's only the agriculturalists that do. And we consider it sort of part of life because everybody gets it. But it's not true. Even in the 1950s, in the Canadian Medical Journal, there was an article about, it started, the first sentence was something like, well, we all know that the Eskimos don't get cancer. And no, you know, they eat, look what they eat. It's, you know, sea mammals and, you know, fish, and there's no sugar in that diet, and they don't get cancer. Of course, everything's changed now. Their traditional life ways have been pretty well destroyed. But, you know, you could watch cancer spread, you know, as what Weston Price called, you know, the displacing foods of modern commerce spread around the globe. But this is not normal. It's not natural. We're not all supposed to get cancer. And even just that one fact, that sugar is what cancer eats, that can save so many lives, just knowing that. You know, take the grain out, take the sugar out, and see what happens.
Yeah, no, we have to emphasize for some listeners who might not know that grains, starch, all that is carbs, carbohydrates, that will eventually be transformed into sugar. So sugar is not only the sweet stuff that we put in tea or coffee.
Yeah, every last molecule of it is broken down into a simple sugar. So you can call it a complex carbohydrate, but by the time it's done with your body, it's been turned into a simple sugar. And every last molecule has to be dealt with by your pancreas and by your insulin receptors. So it's the same thing, you know. The amount of complex carbohydrate that we are being told to eat in the United States, we've got this food pyramid, you know, where at the bottom, the base of your diet is supposed to be carbohydrate. It adds up to 2 cups of sugar a day. I mean, that's how much sugar they're telling us to eat. It's insane. The human body was never meant to process that much sugar. I mean, it's no wonder everybody's so sick. Yeah. I don't know how it is where you are, but everybody here just looks terrible.
Oh, it's
everybody's sick. Everybody has the diabetes and the heart disease and cancer. It's terrible.
It's global.
And, you know, I really feel bad for those people who, you know, they have good intentions, but they want to, they claim that you can live without eating and just, you know, breathe or whatever and stare at this. And I like to know what you tell them, because for me it was like, well, you know, if I'm going to do that, yes, I won't be killing anything, but I won't be thinking, I won't be doing anything with my life. What's the purpose of, you know, having that kind of life when you can't do anything to make a little difference in the world, you know? I mean, but what do you tell these people who say, you know, no, I do believe that you can just do sun gazing and, you know, live from thin air?
These people have an eating disorder. They're anorexic. And seriously, they need help. They have found an ideology that supports their eating disorder. And there's actually a word for that. They call it orthorexia nervosa, like orthodoxy. So orthorexia nervosa. And it's the same thing. And it's the same biochemistry going on where people get addicted to their own starvation. And there is help, but they need help. I mean, and there's only so much you can say to people who are that sick, because it's just a mental illness at that point. Everybody in their lives who cares about them, their family, their friends, those are the people who need to intervene. I mean, they need an intervention, and they need to go to a hospital, because it's just insanity. If you cannot live without calories, you need energy. You are not a plant. You can't photosynthesize. So
yeah,
there's
mean,
not much I can say.
We've seen a couple that give lectures and stuff, you know, because they can survive for like 3 months and they think they feel great. And then 3 months down the road, you hear that they ended up at the hospital. And people are still believing.
Yeah. Or you hear that they've been sneaking Mars bars and Snickers bars when no one was looking, you know.
What is misleading as well, that's not always a direct, immediate correlation between the food you eat and your health and your state of health. There's what we call silent disease, metabolic processes that build up over years and years, and you look healthy for decades maybe, and one day you fall down and you drop dead from an aneurysm, a stroke, a whatever kind of disease. So it's not because a vegetarian looks healthy or whatever, vegetarian or not vegetarian, it's not because someone looks healthy now that is on the right path, nutritionally speaking.
Well, the thing to remember is that you're on drawdown. When you're eating a diet that doesn't contain all the nutrients you need, the minerals, the fat-soluble vitamins, the fat itself, it's all being taken out of some organ or tissue in your body.
Yeah.
And there's only so long that can go on, you know.
Yeah, it seems to me that ultimately, the overview is that the powers that be have instituted a system here on the planet Earth where the food, the basic nutrients that keep people alive, are designed to kill them.
Or keep them so sick and
mentally fogged that they can't do anything about it. That's a conspiracy theory, but, you know, it fits. But it also doesn't necessarily have to be a conspiracy in the sense that it could just be a natural evolution of the kind of psychopathic mindset where they just, you know, it's kind of monkey see, monkey do. It's like, we want this, we're going to go and get it, and to hell with the results. And if you let that perpetuate, you're going to have terrible end results. You're going to have destruction and entropy and a collapse of the system, ultimately.
I know for the ancient Aztec society, which was a corn-based
beyond
civilization.
Beyond, or not so much beyond, but aside from an actual eventual collapse or falling off a cliff or whatever, something that strikes me is that even now, you talk to a lot of people who see a lot of stuff that goes on the planet, but they still fall back on the belief, it is a belief, i.e. it's not true, that things are still good, that they're as good as they ever have been. I mean, there are 8 billion of us. You know, more and more people have access to basic resources, food, and so on. But what quality of life do people have? You know, it's kind of like
slave nation.
It's slave nation, but at the same time, you have in order for it to remain so, they need a kind of rose tinted glasses, ideologies to paper over the reality. But
I think when, as Lear mentioned earlier on, when you say the morphine from gluten and the morphine that you get in queso morphine, I think it is. I mean, people are eating wheat and dairy every day of their lives, most people in the Western world. So they're drugged up and they're loving it, you know. To some extent, obviously, people are having hardship as well and stuff, but it takes the edge off it for a lot of people. I mean, food. I don't think you can discount the effect that food has on people in terms of keeping them content and quiet. And that's why we always say that you really only get a revolution, a real revolution, that has any effect when people go hungry, when you take away their drug, essentially. And we're talking about drugs here, morphine, or a morphine version of morphine.
Yeah, well, opioids keeps you alive enough to be a slave, but not alive enough to free yourself.
Mm-hmm. Are we being too pessimistic, Lear?
Well, I think at
I think
this
she's actually,
point...
I think she's gone for some reason. I think she hung
no,
up.
No, can you hear
drop.
Me?
Oh, well.
Can you hear me? Can you hear me?
I could try.
That's a shame. I was going to ask her.
Oh, no. Can you hear me?
We can get her back. Yeah. I'm curious to know what her diet is like now. I mean, she's talking about animal fats and meat, so she's presumably eating a lot of meat.
Mm-hmm.
Wonder... She's heard of the ketogenic diet, which we've discussed in the show. because it's not just that we've been eating this unnatural diet all this time. There is a natural diet, one that does fit.
Okay, so something's gone wrong where the people listening
can
hear
me?
The air, but we can't for some reason.
Oh, shoot.
That's Blog Talk Radio, you know. Lear, if you're listening, maybe if you just kind of hang up and I'll call you back.
Okay,
so carry on, Neil.
Well, yeah, it's been given this name, ketogenic diet. That sounds like, what is that? But it's basically the natural diet, or would have been for hundreds of thousands, if not millions of years, for developing humans. And so much as we've been eating incorrectly, so to speak, thanks to agriculture over the last 10,000 years, the science today has taken us full circle to showing what real nutrition can be.
Yeah,
and should be.
Yeah, and hang on a second. Are you there, Lear?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Lear, I think we're having a problem here where we can't hear her, but listeners can. Oh. She can hear us. Lear can hear us, and listeners can hear her, but we can't hear her. So we're going to have to, Lear, listen, if you're listening, we're going to have to probably just end it there because, I don't know, if this is our blog talk video, we're going to complain about this terrible service. Anyway, if you're listening, thanks for being on the show. It was great. And maybe we'll have you back on again at another time and we can discuss these issues further.
Sounds like a plan.
Thank you. Thank you for all your work.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you all. And thanks to all the listeners.
We're getting to the end anyway. Okay, so do you want to finish your point, Neil?
No, let's leave it there. I just want to thank Lear for coming on. Thank you for writing your book. Thank you for standing up, and thank you for caring. We need more people like you.
And thank you for the hope.
Yeah. All right, folks. We're going to leave it there for this week. You're all hearing the show outro. We can't even hear the show outro. So Blog Talk Radio is going to get it in the neck. Until next week. Have a good one. Thanks for our chatters and our listeners and our few callers that we didn't get to talk to. We'll be back next week with our show, and you will see what it is sometime during the week in the usual place. Why does that happen? That's terrible.